And welcome to the Comics Canon, the podcast that reads, reviews, and renders judgment on the greatest comic book stories of yesterday and today. In this episode, we discuss The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Volume 1, originally published by America's Best Comics. Join us as we ask the burning questions: how good is this story really? And does it belong in that body of great comic book works known as the Comics Canon? My name is Kevin Morrow.
And my name is Kurt Holman. Salutations, Mr. Moreau.
Yes, and many good returns of the day to you, Mr. Holman.
Shall we discuss The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Mr. Moreau?
By all means, after you, sir.
Okay, no, after you, please, sir. Okay, let's do enough of the Alphonse and Gaston stuff, you know.
Yeah, that's enough gentlemanliness
for now.
That
can go a long way, yeah. We had, as we mentioned at the end of our last episode, we had the idea for this because the Mummy movie came out, and it's the first in kind of the Universal Pictures idea of a what they call a dark universe, a franchise of shared monster movies. So in the new movie, The Mummy, Russell Crowe plays Dr. Jekyll. There's plans for an Invisible Man movie starring Johnny Depp. So they're kind of like trying to get all these characters who are kind of already have been together in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. So we were like, hey, let's just talk about League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. So, you know, that was the idea for this one. And I have some thoughts about The Mummy, but why don't we, I'll save that for after our LXG conversation. And by the way, I might succumb to the temptation to use the LXG abbreviation, which was kind of the logo of the 2003 League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie.
Boy.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that I should hate and think is stupid, but it's a lot easier to say than League of Extraordinary Gentlemen every time. And the actual initials for that is LEG, so LXG just kind of, I kind of like it a little more. So I hate to admit it, I kind of like it, so...
All right. Yeah. I've got something to say about that, but yeah, we'll save that for later. All right. So let's just dive in. We'll do the creators and the summaries, mm-hmm. and then we'll just get to it. So the writer for this, as we mentioned, I believe, is Alan Moore. Artist Kevin O'Neill. Colors by Benedict DeMagmalou. I hope I didn't butcher that too badly. Letters by William Oakley and editor Scott Dunbier, mm-hmm. or Dunbier, maybe. Anyway.
Is there an irony that it's by America's Best Comics, given that Alan Moore and this book in particular are so very English? You know?
Yes, there is.
In doing the summaries, usually we kind of write our own summaries by, you know, just going through the issues. There are six issues with this. But with the sixth issue of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, there's the cover is like it's like a parody of like an old, I guess, the equivalent of like a Sunday comic strip type thing. And there's a rhyme that summarizes the events up until then. So I thought we would use that instead of our usual summaries. But so it makes sense, I think we should mention who the characters are. The overall concept of the book is that it's taking all these characters from Victorian literature, primarily Victorian, certainly 19th century literature, and kind of putting them together like a superhero team, basically. So the primary ones that we have are Wilhelmina Murray, a.k.a. Mina Harker from Dracula, Captain Nemo from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Alan Quatermain, the great hunter from King Solomon's Mines, Dr. Jekyll from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, of course, Holly Griffin from The Invisible Man, and I should mention that the anti-gravity material known as Caverite from First Men of the Moon is in it. There's also one of the main characters is this spy master named Campion Bond, who in looking at like sort of the appendices about the book and kind of the online, you know, kind of guesswork, might be an original character, but he's clearly intended to be an ancestor for James Bond. You know?
Yeah, I believe he's supposed to be James Bond's grandfather. Mm-hmm. And that may be touched on in a later book. I've only read the first two volumes. Yeah. I haven't read volume 3 or the Black Dossier or any of the later stuff.
Yeah, I've read the three Century books and the three Nemo spinoffs, but never have some reason the Black Dossier has kind of like fell in between the cracks. So, and also we should say that the book is kind of a satire of the Victorian attitudes of the era that these came out. So in terms of its like racial and gender politics, it's sort of deliberately chauvinistic and anachronistic, which will become pretty apparent, you know, pretty soon. So I'll get started. Through trusting in a portly gent, our chums have an embarrassment. Meeting Miss Murray on the pier, stout Mr. Bond cooed in her ear. Now, you must leave for a foreign land, there to enlist a doughty band, who'll serve our country and our queen, to Egypt now by submarine. So, aided by a foreign gent, a naval captain, off she went.
In Egypt, from the addict's pain, they rescued Mr. Quatermain, taking him with them neath the sea as they embarked for gay Paris. In Paris, they were satisfied to nab the beastly Edward Hyde, then sail him back to Albion Fair, awaiting further orders there.
They found their last chum in, what fun, a girls' school in North Edmonton. With Griffin taken firm in hand, our extraordinary band discover the outrageous plan of crafty Johnny Chinaman, who's stolen Blighty's Caverite, a medal with the power of flight.
In Limehouse at the Archfiend's lair, they end his mastery of the air and see the mystery element return to England's government. In river tunnels deep as night, they seek the fearful Caverite so that they can at once abscond with it to give to Mr. Bond.
The chubby fellow's filled with glee. You've all done jolly well, says he. Take this reward and have some nosh, a slap-up meal at Maison Posh. The Caverite, with great relief, I'll give to Mr. M, my chief. He'll be delighted, I just know. Still, simply mustache, cheerio.
But wait, what's this? M, all this time, was the Napoleon of crime. Professor Moriarty cries, tonight my Chinese rival dies. I'll simply bomb East London flat. See what the blighter makes of that. Horrors, how can our comrades win? To learn the answer, seek within.
Just reviewing this today, I was the last part where it starts. But wait, what's this? Reminded me of the narrator of the 1966 Batman show, and it kind of reminded me of the death of Adam West, which made me a little sad. But it's kind of playing in that heightened, you know, narration, obviously.
Yeah, and definitely that happens a lot in the kind of next issue blurbs at the end of each individual chapter of this that are in what I can only assume, having not read a ton of them myself, is the style of, you know, the adventure kind of pulps of that period, the pre-pulps, I guess, proto-pulps of that period. And the tone of those is really fun.
Yeah. One thing I think we should agree is like to not go through and identify every reference.
Yes, absolutely. Because
this would take, you know, 2 hours basically. And in some cases, it's almost like any character with an identifiable face is probably someone from some kind of literature, or, you know, but and some of them I've got mentioned, but we'll get into those as we come along.
Yeah, and if you're really interested in that, there's a gentleman named James Jess Nevins who put together an annotated book that goes into great detail about every character in here, and I believe later volumes as well.
Yeah, so. And it's funny how this is almost like a comedy version of From Hell, in the sense that in that case, Moore had lots of references to, you know, London in 1888 and the history of the time, but kind of to support this big conspiracy involving, you know, 19th century England and the Jack the Ripper murders. And here he's just kind of like having fun with their literature and bringing it all to, as much as he possibly can think of, basically.
Yeah, and art-wise, this is very different from Hell as well. Mm-hmm. Kevin O'Neill, who probably best known, especially at the time, for his series Martial Law, works in this very kind of angular, almost, I want to say, sinister style that works really well for this story.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of, he'll have these big panels where it'll be like, you know, a slum in Limehouse or London's East End, and it'll be this big splash page, and the structures will look very rickety almost.
Yeah.
And there's lots of like detail crammed in that remind me a little bit of like old, like Popeye comic strips and things like that.
You know,
so it kind of fits the era, even though Popeye's a little bit later, you know, so, And one thing I kind of alluded to this already, but I read these when they originally came out in the late 90s, and visiting them now, they're a little bit more obviously satirical than I remember. You know, at first I was like just kind of enjoying the story and kind of the comedic bits I recognize, but I think there's a more deep level of satire going on, and I thought I would mention that just to end the character of Alan Quartermain and how he's this, you know, kind of embodiment of the great white hunter and the, you know, Victorian male ideal at the time. And here he's this aging opium addicted wreck, you know. So it seems very like he's, this is kind of his Moore's idea of, you know, where the that Victorian ideal is going to end up, basically.
Yeah, that's an astute point. And the inversion of common gender roles really strikes me with Quartermain and Mina Harker, Miss Murray. Mm-hmm. He's, like you said, he's an opium addict, basically. He's bedraggled, and he's in sharp contrast to, you know, the rugged, you know, great hunter, the great white hunter, you know, of, you know, H. Rider Haggard. Mm-hmm. He's this kind of older guy who just sort of complains a lot, even when he's not, even when he's not, you know, in the thrall of his addiction anymore. He still like takes objection to everything that, that Murray says.
Well, they have a, kind of a traditional, bickering romantic couple vibe, you know? So, and it's kind of, which was a little bit more obvious the second time going into it too.
And she's very much the take charge, strong-willed, stiff upper lip type. I just was really struck by that that contrast. Yeah, he's kind of the weak one in that relationship. And there's only like a couple of points in the story where he really takes charge of things. There's a scene when they check into a flop house. I think it's when they're looking for the Invisible Man. Mm. No, not the Invisible
Man. It's when they're investigating the Fu Manchu's thing, you know. Yeah.
Who is not referred to by that name here, for copyright reasons. Yeah. But... yeah, he grabs her and kisses her because someone's coming, and he just wants it to look like they were looking for an out of the way place to have a liaison, because it's a gender segregated flop house. Mm-hmm. And then the kind of the funny scene when they're going into the tunnel where Fu Manchu's airship is being built, and he brings along his elephant gun.
Yeah, it seems like he's overcompensating.
A little bit.
Well, one thing to kind of follow his arc a bit, you know, it's like she first sees him in Egypt, and, you know, he's in an opium haze, and she's attacked, and, you know, uses a gun to defend her, basically, and, you know, they escape. He kind of dries out and detoxes in the submarine.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a great moment where he wakes up in the submarine, probably not sure that that's where he is, looks out a window that's a porthole, and there's like a deep sea fish staring back at him through the window, you know? And when they get to Paris, and they're at the Rue Morgue, and the whole sequence is evoking the Edgar Allan Poe's Murder in the Rue Morgue, you know, in which it was an orangutan, you know. He kind of leaves his post to get some laudanum, you know, because he's still in his opium addiction, you know, which is kind of a sign that he has, like, he's still struggling with his weakness. But when they finally fight Mr. Hyde, he pours the laudanum down his throat, which causes him to lose consciousness. And I don't think he reverts back at that point, but at least it knocks him out. And it's like he's using his weakness as a weapon, you know? So I think that's kind of a point where he starts to turn, you know? So he's not completely incompetent, but he's kind of over his head the whole time, you know?
So let's talk about the League itself. Yeah. We've gone through the main characters, and as is often the case in origin stories for teams like this, you have some clashing character dynamics. The team barely knows each other, let alone trust each other. And there are two, not just one, but two active antagonists, loose cannons, if you will, in Hyde and Holly.
Yeah.
And that kind of pays off more in the second volume, which we're not talking about today. Yeah. But the whole thing feels like group feels like it could fall apart in any moment. And in fact, I'd like to have seen a little bit more of that.
More of the tension between
them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you have Nemo, who is, you know, who doesn't look like, say, James Mason from I think it was a TV movie.
No, James Mason was in the original Disney movie, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And in the, I read the, not big, probably from reading the comics, I read the book, and they don't mention him being Indian, as in from India, in the first book, but I think it's something that comes up in Mysterious Island. So, but Moore has kind of embraced that aspect of the character. So he's straight up, you know, kind of an Indian national who's very angry at the English for their colonialism, you know. Yeah. So he has, so he's very, you know, the fact that he's kind of helping the English government is, it's a little much, a bit of a stretch, you know, but he's like openly suspicious of the English and Quatermain in particular as kind of a representative of the English.
Well, he mentions that if he's helping the British government, it's because he feels he's like a man of the sea now. He feels.
Yeah, that's his the nationality that he identifies with isn't even nation. Yeah. He's like a man of the sea more than any specific place.
Yeah, he doesn't identify as a person from India any more than he does with England.
Yeah.
Although he does still bristle when he
seems to really hate the English though. Yeah. So
and it gets under his skin when he has to sort of pretend like to be there. Like a manservant
yeah.
or something like that. Yeah.
One thing about when they investigate the Hyde murders at the Rue Morgue, you know, they think that it might be an orangutan again or some like ape-like creature. And it turns out to be Mr. Hyde, who's this huge hulking figure, which is in contrast to how he appears in the Robert Louis Stevenson book, where he's like actually smaller than the Henry Jekyll. And I think partly it's more playing with the Bruce Banner, Incredible Hulk dynamic, except in this case, you know, the Hulk is, because he's like, it's kind of comparable size-wise to the Hulk, only with none of like the conscience of the Hulk. So he's like a straight up berserk murderer, even though he can speak and spew profanity and hateful language. So he's like intelligent, but he's, you know, also, you know, completely bloodthirsty. So he's like, you know, this is kind of like Hulk as like an actual rage monster, you know.
Yeah, I read an interview with Alan Moore in which he said that he thought that the superhero genre seemed to spring largely from 19th century fiction and that, you know, the first generation of superheroes really mirrored this, like at least in the Marvel Age of Heroes. The Hulk is obviously Jekyll and Hyde, and you've got a nod to the... And he says, you've got a nod to Wells' Invisible Man in the Fantastic Four's Invisible Woman. And he had decided to go and play with that in a little bit more detail, kind of thinking about what kind of world those characters would inhabit together. And that's what I really like about this is a lot of the fun is not just spotting the references, but it's the world that he extrapolates from that, which is like, you know, like in Marvel Comics, a version similar to our own, but a bit more fantastic. Like, say, when you first see the Nautilus come up.
Yeah.
it's a very striking image.
Yeah. And one thing that's fun about the design of it is that there's the famous scene of, like, the Nautilus fighting the squid. And this, like, the Nautilus has a design that's like a squid.
Yeah.
You know? So it's, like, kind of, like, bringing these two concepts together and, like, visually, you know. And I guess the last member of the team is the Invisible Man, Howley Griffin, and he is like the one in the book, you know, and is like kind of a complete sociopath, megalomaniac, you know. And in this, it's like they find him in this girls' school where he's basically sleeping with these young women, and so like I think three of them are pregnant and they think it's from like the Holy Spirit or something like that. And I'm not a big fan of this sequence in it. Yeah, I mean, it's in a part where Moore says he's, you know, like in kind of the parts where there's like a threatened rape scene in the first issue in the Egyptian part, and Moore commented that he's kind of commenting on the Victorian attitudes towards, you know, the other and, you know, sexuality and like rape as the fate worse than death, you know. So I get that, and I think that comes across. He says at one point in the interview, he said, it's more British attitudes that are being pilloried rather than the targets of those attitudes, which I think is fair, but it still like kind of makes me uncomfortable in a way that, you know, I don't really like, even as a bit of satire, you know. But I was striking kind of researching about it that the like all the characters that we see in the girls' school are, you know, from literature, and I believe the three women are one is from The Bostonians by Henry James, one is Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm, and one is Pollyanna. And
they mention her by name.
Yeah, and some of this I don't really know, except you'll hear that. let's scratch that, you know. But even like supporting characters they mentioned are from actual like Victorian erotica, like I think like Ms. Flaybum, you know. So the references go pretty deep, basically, you know. But anyway, but kind of they get the Invisible Man on that and get him on their team. And like you said, they're all so strange and seem so unstable as a team that it's like, why would they enlist them to do something that they actually want? You know, on one level, they're like, some of them have, you know, have superhuman powers or skills or, you know, transportation abilities with like the submarine, but also they're like seen as expendable. So if, you know, they die, they won't really be missed. It's a kind of comic book thing where you can't analyze too much because obviously it doesn't make any sense that these people would be brought together as a team, you know?
Yeah. So the scene with Holly, yeah, mm-hmm. and it's very graphic, mm-hmm. even though it's an invisible man
yeah.
doing the deflowering.
Yeah.
And there are some scenes of violence too that can mm-hmm. be a little unsettling. And it's odd to me in a way because I feel like there are two poles to this story. Mm-hmm. There's one where they're showing, you know, there's graphic sexual and physical violence. Mm-hmm. And on the other, I've always looked at the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen as being kind of a part of a quest on Alan Moore's part to not just deconstruct superheroes, because I think he was pretty much done with them as a concept by this point, but to harken back to earlier forms of adventure storytelling and to kind of restore, get back to a sense of wonder. Mm-hmm. Back in 1993, he did this series, 1963 for Image Comics, which seemed to be like a mea culpa for having ushered in the grim and gritty era with Watchmen. And kind of like looking at, you know, all right, for all its faults, you know, early Marvel comics, you know, were a lot of fun, you know, and sometimes like we just need to be reminded that comics are supposed to be fun. And I think that there are things that he was doing in the 90s, the America's Best Comics line, top 10, Tom Strong, and even his run on Supreme for Rob Liefeld Image, and maybe even at Liefeld's Awesome Comics in the 90s, were this attempt to sort of like, look how fun this stuff can be. And I feel like on one level, League is a part of that. You know, it's like, look, this is really all about, you know, just childhood heroes and kind of a sense of wonder, and look how neat it is when the Nautilus rises up out of the river and all these things. And on the other hand, you have like these uncomfortable and really, you know, gruesome scenes.
Yeah. The, I mean, I don't know if the, we should say that like the sexuality is super graphic.
No, it is not.
It's not graphic in terms of like, you know, showing body parts or things like
that. No, it's not irreversible.
Yeah. But the violence is, you know, extremely gruesome. And it's almost like I was thinking that when he wrote the character of Rorschach for Watchmen, you know, he's like this violent psychopath. And he was, I believe he'd commented like that, you know, he's like, he wants people not to think that he's cool. Then people thought that Rorschach was cool anyway. So we're going to have like Mr. Hyde, like ripping people apart and dismembering them, like quote unquote on camera here, you know? So it's like,
and there's a scene of Nemo shooting a harpoon through a couple of guys early on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, even stuff that's not as graphic as that. Mm-hmm. Like there's a scene where, Quatermain and Jekyll are looking for someone and they're in Limehouse, and he happens to see through an open door while he's talking to somebody, Fu Manchu in the room behind him, etching like Chinese characters into some poor guy's flesh, with acid.
Yeah.
And you're like, what? Like, that's almost even more unsettling in a way than the scenes, like you mentioned, of Hyde, like just tearing people's limbs off.
Yeah. But I would say that, and that, you know, Fu Manchu is presented at, I mean, like you said, he's not identified by name. They could just call him the doctor, but he's unmistakably Fu Manchu. But he's obviously the villain of the piece. And, you know, Hyde and the Invisible Man are supposedly the heroes because they're part of the title team, you know, and they're like, they're the ones who are supposed to be kind of rooting for. But there's a part in the fifth issue where the Invisible Man, he's like been spying on Campion Bond and discovers that, you know, that his boss is Moriarty. He's like going back and is cold. So he basically kills a Bobby in cold blood and, you know, messes up his face, you know, basically for no reason, just so he can steal his clothes. You know?
Yeah.
So it's clearly this guy is crazy and bloodthirsty and it means nothing to him. And it's unsettling, you know, and you kind of like, it's hard to just say, it's like, oh, well, he's just a cool Suicide Squad guy. You know, it's like, no, this is creepy. Yeah.
Yeah. And that touches on one of the things that sticks with me the most about this is these characters aren't very sympathetic. Even Quatermain and Harker,
yeah.
or Murray,
yeah.
I should say, it's hard to root for them so much as it is to, like, you don't really find yourself cheering for them to accomplish their mission so far so much as you're actually just kind of swept along by the charm of the conceit
yeah.
and you know, the coolness, for lack of a more professional sounding yeah. word, of seeing things like, you know, a floating airship and, you know, Fu Manchu's Chinese henchmen on, you know, attacking it on flying kites and yeah. things like that.
The only thing about Marie is like, supposedly she's kind of fighting for respect, but more she's like complaining about the lack of respect that she gets,
yeah.
which she is very justified and has a complete point, but it kind of doesn't make her more likable in a way. I guess it's sort of a no-win situation for women in this kind of position where, you know, if they have to assert their rights, they're, you know, interpreted as being quote unquote shrill or abrasive or something like that, you know, but I appreciate her as, you know, the de facto leader of the team,
yeah.
you know, and how, what a thankless job it is for yeah. her, you know, and how she's smart and keeping them all together kind of through force of will, basically, even yeah. though they all, none of them appreciate her for it.
Yeah. Know? And she's the closest to being a sympathetic character. And even if we give Alan Moore the credit here, that aspect that you just pointed out, you know, was something that he had in mind, you know, it was on purpose as a bit of commentary about yeah. Women at the time. It still remains that, like,
yeah.
she doesn't come across all that well.
She's not very, well, she's not very warm as a yeah. character, I would say, you know. One thing that I'll just kind of mention as an aside is that the kind of the romance develops between them. Mm-hmm. And there's probably at least 30 years between them. And it's just sort of not commented on, but it's like, not crazy about that, you know. I had wanted to mention Fu Manchu a bit,
yeah.
and his presence in here and how he wasn't in the movie version. And I was wondering, like, can you even have Fu Manchu in a work and have it not be racist, you know? Because he was like, I guess Sax Rohmer was the author
right.
of the Fu Manchu pulp yeah. books. And I don't think he's ever been played by an actual Asian actor in movies, but he's such a like charismatic villain who's just so, and he's like an evil genius and he's powerful and smart. So he's not like a weak character, even though he's this horrible racist stereotype, you know? So it's like, you know, so like, it seems like you just shouldn't even bother to try and have him, you know, if you're like a white creator, basically, you know, but it's like, but he's very charismatic. I kind of wish there was a way. It's almost like, is this a character you had to kind of like retire just because he's so politically incorrect, you know?
I think in the right hands that he could work, you yeah. know, you take away some of the, you know, the stilted English of his henchmen or,
yeah.
or things like that. I mean, given the time and place, yes, like there are,
yeah.
there are factors to consider there. Like, so it would be like, you know, can you have a black villain in a Civil War story? You know,
yeah.
like, I see that there are, you know, that there are some really murky waters there, but yeah. I feel yeah. like I feel like in the right hands that he, you know, if you're really kind of conscious of things that he probably could be pulled off.
Yeah.
Well.
And I think he's, executed fine here. I don't think it's like problematic, but he's not really an important character. He doesn't, I don't think, ever speak, you know, on panel, you know, so he's sort of just this ominous background figure, basically.
Right. Yeah. And he's not even the,
he's not even the main villain. You know? Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I like about this story is, there are two villains and the big, you know, end of the second act revelation is of course the fact that, the big villain is Mr. Moriarty, who's been, the man behind the scenes the whole time, manipulating them through Campion Bond.
Campion Bond had said that his boss was named M, which is a reference to, you know, James Bond's boss being M, of course. And Murray assumed that meant the M stood for Mycroft, as in Mycroft Holmes, Sherlock Holmes' smarter brother, who was a spy master. And in fact, M is for Moriarty, like they revealed. Right. You know?
And of course, Mycroft becomes their handler, for lack of a better word, at the end of the series.
Yeah. Well, one thing I want to say while we're getting into like the sort of the action-y scenes in the back half is how well executed the Invisible Man scenes are.
Yeah.
There'll be these long kind of scenes that are either like, kind of from his point of view or from, you know, just behind him, but you can't see him. So you kind of see kind of more the effects of him passing through a place or something like that. And the panel structure in this is often similar to Watchmen, where it's like very uniform panels in a similar kind of structure. So it works as almost like storyboards and in a very cinematic way. And so it's very compelling. And the fact that they're kind of implying a physical presence where you can't see one is done really well. So I think that's particularly well executed in this.
Yeah. I had mentioned Kevin O'Neill's artwork earlier, but it bears kind of going into a little deeper here, how essential he is to this story. I think I remember when I was first reading this, I was a little dubious. I really only knew him from having flipped through a couple of issues of Martial Law, I think in the 80s or maybe early 90s or whenever. And I was like, I don't know, like, is this really the guy you want for a Victorian period piece? But he does really well. His sense of scale, his sense of detail for big scenes, like you mentioned, Limehouse, look, you know, and it looks kind of like a shanty town. The big bridge, you know, the airship, like the set pieces he does really, really well. And things like you're talking about his execution of the scenes with Griffin are really expertly done. His depiction of Quatermain in the beginning, like it's really harrowing and it drives home, you know, just how much he's not, you know, the rugged He-Man adventurer that you're expecting when you hear that name. So he's as much a part of the success of this book as Moore. And I believe Moore has credited him, for example, with, Nemo being an Indian that Moore had just, you know, had just read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and assumed it was like, you know, he looked like James Mason.
Yeah.
And it was Kevin O'Neill, I think, who said, well, actually, so he's a true collaborator. And from what I, you know, from the second volume and from the bits and pieces I've seen of the other stories, seems to really do well like, across a spectrum of backdrops and styles and time periods. So, really taken with his artwork in this.
I'm going to say, I like the part where Hyde, as Mr. Hyde sees Griffin the first time and actually sees him, because we discover that Hyde basically has infrared vision, so he can see kind of the heat shape, so he's not invisible to Hyde. And there's a part where you get, there's like this, not very long, but there's a kind of an exchange with him where Griffin seems to think that Hyde is seeing him, you know, so he's like, the tunnel's this way, and you see kind of the infrared invisible man pointing a direction, and Hyde says, well, you're invisible, I can't tell where you're pointing, so, you know, it's like this little cat and mouse game between them that's going to, like, pay off in volume two, basically. But
And not to spoil it, but that is also a very brutal and uncomfortable scene.
We don't need to get into that. No. If we do the volume two sometime, we'll get into that. But you were mentioning just kind of the the fun of the book and things like just kind of like the action set pieces where they're under Limehouse trying to escape and they've got the Caverite and they're in this kind of underwater tunnel. So they basically, you know, use the elephant gun to bring down the tunnel and use the Caverite to float up through the water. Yeah. It's a great action scene, you know. And in the last book, kind of the plot was that Fu Manchu had built this kind of dragon-shaped airship that he was going to use to attack London, and they got the Caverite and destroyed it. But Professor Moriarty, getting the Caverite, has his own airship, and he's going to basically bomb East London, you know, to destroy Fu Manchu and his, you know, and all these innocent people, you know, possibly. And so they kind of go off to stop them. And so there's this part where the Moriarty's bat-like, you know, ship is bombing the East End, and the League go after him in a hot air balloon, which I think is from Around the World in 80 Days. And Fu Manchu not only has like a cannon, but also they've got these like one-man fighter kites. Yeah. So these Chinese guys are flying in the air with these like dragon kites, like these little hang gliders, you know, and it's just this crazy aerial fighting scene with not a ton of panels, you know, for those parts, but they're like big panels that have all this information in them. So it's like,
yeah, and that spread is really
awesome.
Yeah. And I completely agree. Mm. And to get back to, the elephant gun for a minute, which you just mentioned, Chekhov's elephant gun, if you will.
Yeah.
Like, it pays off why Quatermain brings it with him in the first place.
Yeah.
And like, I had completely bought in when he's like, oh, he had seen a glimpse of the doctor, Fu Manchu, torturing the one helpless guy, and was so shaken that he brings it along for protection. And you look at it in hindsight and you're like, I don't know, that seems kind of weak. Yeah. But at the time, like, I totally bought into it. It made complete sense. So
yeah, you'd think that you'd want something you could shoot multiple times and just not once in that kind of situation. But
I was like, well, I'll allow it.
Yeah. I wanted to say, the first time we see Moriarty, like Campion Bond is like going to his office. We don't see Moriarty yet, but we hear his voice say, Mr. Bond, I've been expecting you, which is one of those, you know, James Bond cliches, you know, which is funny, you know. They have it. This book has like a recreation of the Reichenbach Fall scene from Sherlock Holmes, which in the original Holmes story is like, I think, basically off camera, you know, it's quote unquote, or, you know, off stage. And we get from Watson's point of view, but, you know, and Holmes was presumed dead, that they both were presumed dead in the fall. And, you know, and this, we found out that actually neither of them died. So, you know, it's like, it's a nice little bit, but it's almost like Moore's kind of go back and fill in a blank rather than, you know, create this kind of, then take the story in a different direction.
Yeah.
You
know? All right, so anything else you want to talk about the book in particular?
There are a couple of other things I wanted to mention. One is that how it's, and the story anticipates like 20th century warfare with like aerial warfare and bombing from above as being something that happens, and Nemo having basically machine guns, you know, which were new, and like Ms. Murray like sees it and is horrified and says it's so unsporting, which is both, you know, kind of a comedic, stuffy thing to say, but also a note of like justifiable horror at seeing, you know, the ability to kill people at such quantity, you know. So I thought that was interesting. I like in using the Invisible Man, there are parts where like characters will be having an action and suddenly like a knife will start moving. And so it's like he was there possibly the whole time, which is particularly when they're trying to escape from Moriarty's airship and it's falling and they're going back to the hot air balloon, and they get there and they see the rope that's holding it to the airship is being cut by a knife, and they're like, Griffin, you know, so it's like, oh, I didn't think you'd be back. You know, he was like cutting the rope free so he could escape without them, you know? So, and the last page of it is, meteorites coming down the sky, which are from, you know, H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, which they kind of hinted was in the cards and kind of one of the previous issues. So it's sort of like, you know, it's like, oh, like, what do they do next when like Martians are involved, basically, you know?
One small detail that just came to mind that I like is, as we've mentioned before, almost all of the characters here are, you know, existing fictional characters to the point where there's a scene where Nemo is asking his two crew members what they think of this motley organization that's been assembled. And one of them goes, call me Ishmael.
Yeah, he calls him mate. He says, call me Ishmael. You've known me long enough.
It was like, to the point that the narrator of one of the most important works in all of English literature is like a throwaway gag here. And really struck me as funny.
The most obscure one that I never would have guessed is apparently when he's like attacking the East End, that you see a bunch of like characters and they're ancestors of the characters from the TV show EastEnders. Which I never would. It's, you know, it's like it goes really deep, you know. Well, do you want to get into the reckoning?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it.
So when we have our reckoning, it's when we decide if a book, you know, is worthy of entry to the comics canon. And we try to think of it as having a criteria of artistic excellence or lasting influence, or just that like little X factor that makes it irresistible. And we have a vote, and our vote has to be unanimous for it to have inclusion. So do you want to go? Or shall I go?
Yeah. I'll go first. Yeah. I vote yes. Mm-hmm. I don't have a ton of criticisms about this, and any that I have are really small. I did mention, for example, earlier that it's kind of hard to root for anyone, and it's definitely very bleak, which is really more of a personal thing because, as I said, you know, I read it the first time with the idea in mind that it was part of Moore's kind of trying to harken back to an earlier sense of wonder in comics and adventure stories in general. There are some moments that kind of make you cringe from a 21st century social perspective. But as you've mentioned, a lot of that is intentional. Mm-hmm. And I've read an interview or two where Moore says the same thing, where he's poking fun at Victorian attitudes. Yeah. I love the concept. It goes by really quickly, and there are just a lot of fun scenes in it. So I'm not to overthink it. I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's yes for me too. You read this and you think, you know, having seen the 2003 movie, it's like, why didn't they just use this like literally as a storyboard for the film? Because that film is terrible, you know. And one thing I was thinking about it is that Moore has a lot of works, you know, especially from like the 80s and 90s, that I think of as like it's basically genius comic works. And I don't really think of this as genius. I think of it as like very, 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 very clever, but maybe not to that upper level.
I agree.
And like the characters aren't complex really, but I feel invested in them and I enjoy their kind of friction against each other as like mismatched teammates and stuff like that. So, but I do feel like he's really enjoying himself with this. And it might be kind of like one of the last times I feel like he was enjoying himself with a comic book story. A lot of his other like comic stories at the time, he didn't seem, you might have liked them more, but I've never felt like with Tom Strong, he felt very invested in that.
I feel the same way, like actually. That,
I think he really enjoys this, and it's almost wonder if it's like he bought into it kind of more than he expected to, you know.
Yeah. While we're talking about the America's Best Comics line for a minute, I think Tom Strong and to a lesser extent Top 10 were more just ideas that, he liked the ideas. He might not have been as invested in the execution. I do feel like he had a lot of fun with this. I think Promethea, which is my favorite of those, is the closest to approaching the complexity and the richness of ideas of some of his best work.
With Promethea, I mean, I think that's true, and I think that he's very interested in the ideas. The narrative and the characters in Promethea don't do a lot for me. So that's kind of where they diverge.
There are things that hold it from being in the same class as Watchmen or V for Vendetta or even The Anatomy Lesson. Absolutely. But no, this is just a ton of fun from beginning to end.
Congratulations, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. You are now entered the comics canon. So I wanted to now have a short mini podcast called Mummy Talk, where I talk about the movie The Mummy, which I've seen and you haven't.
Right.
And The Mummy is terrible. It is disastrous. You know, it is like I went in, you know, hoping for the best, had heard kind of not great things, and it was worse than expected, basically. And it's not like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where the idea is good and the execution is failure on almost every level. And this one, the concepts are so, it's trying to do so many things and the concepts are kind of incompatible that it seems like there was no way someone could make this work, you know, because it's trying to like, you know, launch this Dark Universe franchise. So there'd be like these universal monsters like Frankenstein and the Wolfman, the Mummy, that they would have like new movies of them and then they could all come together like the Avengers, basically. So it's not so much like a horror movie. It's like an action special effects movie. So it's not really trying to be that scary, even though there are monsters and things in it. It's trying to reboot the like 1990s Mummy franchise, which is, you know, this light Indiana Jones-esque franchise that I wasn't particularly a fan of. So this Mummy starts off with like this kind of swashbuckling, bumbling humor action scenes, which are like terrible at all and not really in tone with kind of where the rest of the movie is going. And Tom Cruise is the lead, and it's kind of made to be a Tom Cruise vehicle. So he has to be kind of the most important character and has the most important arc, but he's not the Mummy. And and his relationship to this sort of shared monster verse and this organization that like hunts monsters is kind of vague. So it kind of throws everything off and it ends in this really very unsatisfying way. So it's just like, it just doesn't work on any of the levels it's trying to work on, you know? And it kind of bugs me because it's like, well, you could do a shared universe monster movie and, you know, have a bunch of movies that are like are trying to be relevant for the 21st century and build a sense of mood and, you know, uncertainty, and they could, you know, cross over. But that isn't what this is doing. So it's just like, it's like all these movies like try and make shared universes, but start with like a really terrible foundation. So, well, of course this isn't going to work, you know?
Yeah. And I've read your review about that, and It Comes at Night in Creative Living here in Atlanta. And you're absolutely right that, say what you will about everyone trying to start their own shared universe, the universal monsters, as we know them, you know, make a ton of sense for that. And it might be easy to sit here and think, that's so easy. How could you mess it up? Yeah. Well, this is how, apparently.
Yeah. Well, just like making them basically the Monster Avengers. It's like, well, that's, here's your problem. You know? Yeah. So anyway, so thank you. I mean, there's someone like Guillermo del Toro, I don't know if I said that, but I could see him being an overseer of that and maybe directing the first one and getting other people, like-minded people to do it. And the movies would have a shared sensibility and tone. And that seems like a way that would make sense, you know?
Absolutely.
But yeah. So anyway, so okay, that's enough for Mummy talk. So now I guess we'll get to, should we go to the spinner rack next?
Yeah. Well, I want to read a couple of
Some letters.
Letters
or comments, yeah.
Reviews, but we're lumping them in under letters. And in deference to you, I will refrain from naming this segment Cannon Fodder.
Thank you.
Although I have to say, you're fine with using LXG to refer to this story, but Cannon Fodder, you have a problem.
Yeah.
Okay. It's anyway, so
we could call it LXG and be letters something something.
Letters that are extremely generous. So, this is by the first one is fun podcast, a 5-star review by HBK Extreme. It's a fun and insightful podcast. The two hosts are very knowledgeable, and while I may disagree on one or two of their conclusions, I can see why they made them nonetheless. Very entertaining. Thank you.
Thank you to the Extreme.
Yeah. And this is the second one. You guys got me. Worth subscribing to by Tan Ninja, a 4-star review. Genuine and grounded voice to classic comic fans without being too hipster. It's refreshing. No one is dialing up a personality to play to the podcast. You guys seem very into what you talk about, which gets me into it. I like it when you talk the stories through and see how the aspects of comics have changed and evolved over time. This is a worthy podcast to subscribe to. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tan Ninja.
Yeah, and
that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and I do feel like I want to point out that, what I like, and I think we've both striven to do from the beginning, is to just be honest and genuine and not try to put on fake personalities, you know, and or create like a fake antagonistic relationship or or one of us take on the mantle of the guy who says, controversial things.
Okay, we didn't ask for your biography, Kevin. Let's go.
No, neither one of us tries to be the troll or anything like that. I appreciate that that comes through. And thank you both very much. We do genuinely appreciate any feedback and correspondence that we get. And iTunes reviews, especially, since they really do help to move us up in the ranks and help people to find us. So feel encouraged to do that. All right, so now let's move into the spinner rack, which is our recommendation segment. Kurt?
Why don't you go?
Yeah. All right.
Okay, no, I'll go because you just read the letters. Yes. Well, I've got a few things. First is one of the spinoffs of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which is the Nemo Heart of Ice. And it's funny with the League books, as they kind of go along, I felt like Moore gets less interested in the characters and more kind of into the the gamesmanship of, having all these references and making them interconnect in ways that, that he finds rewarding and are interesting, but kind of an intellectual way, but I don't feel as invested in them. I wasn't as invested in Century, and the Nemo trilogy, I guess, is more fun, and it's kind of, I think it tended to be lighter than the Century book is. And the first one is the one I enjoyed the most, and it's basically Captain Nemo's daughter, who is now the pilot of the Nautilus, and Nemo Heart of Ice involves going to Antarctica, and so it's bringing all these other Antarctican adventures together in one place, including some famous H.P. Lovecraft work. So it's the most Lovecraftian of these stories. And I enjoy it a lot on that level.
Cool.
And my other ones are prose works. One is a novel called Anno Dracula from 1992 by Kim Newman, which I believe was an influence on League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And it's basically kind of it's a literary mashup in novel form where the conceit is that in the novel Dracula, Dracula won at the end, and he's kind of basically the prince consort of England. So there's this vampiric ruling class now, and there are other characters in it who are like vampires from other literature. And I'm not sure how many other literary figures are in it, but there are also historical figures, because it creates this basically elaborate spin on the Jack the Ripper murders. So if you like this and you like From Hell, Anno Dracula is right up your alley, basically.
Cool.
And the other is a short story by Neil Gaiman called A Study in Emerald, which was written for an anthology that was for stories that combined the Sherlock Holmes mythos and the H.P. Lovecraft mythos. So,
very nice.
So, and it's, I think someone, it might have been Gaiman himself, was saying that like Holmes is so rational that it would seem incompatible to have him and the cyclopean non-Euclidean geometries of H.P. Lovecraft, but he kind of finds a way that's very clever. So, I recommend that very much,
Well, I will read that, but I think that's, that only makes sense.
Yeah.
You can only contrast the horror of Lovecraft's creatures with like the most rational man alive.
Yeah.
That I think that's where you get the conflict and the friction.
Yeah.
All right. So my first pick, I have a couple as well, is a comic by a famous British writer who presents a different take on some famous fictional characters. Wait, didn't we just do that? But no, this is also the aforementioned Neil Gaiman. It's a Marvel 1602 by Neil Gaiman and Andy Kubert and Richard Eisenhove, in which the heroes of the Marvel Universe are transposed to the early 1600s. Mm-hmm. It's not like one of Neil Gaiman's top works either, but it's a fun read. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is Rough Riders Volume 1, Give Them Hell, by Adam Glass and Pat Olaf, published by Aftershock Comics. It's a recent series from last year, I think. It's basically the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but with real-life historical figures instead of fictional characters. The lead is a dashing young Theodore Roosevelt, who kind of acts as a proto-Batman. Like, you're introduced to him as he's got these flight goggles on that look kind of like the talons in the Court of Owls.
Okay.
And he's like gliding in to a burning building to save like some women who are trapped in there.
Like Teddy Roosevelt did.
Yeah, as he does. Yeah. So he puts together a group including Harry Houdini, Thomas Edison, Jack Johnson, the boxer, and Annie Oakley to combat a mysterious threat against the backdrop of the Spanish-American mm-hmm. War. And it's a fun read, and it, you know, like more, it doesn't just take the premise and say, all right, here's a bunch of characters. Mm-hmm. It kind of delves a little deeply into the backgrounds of these characters and where they were at this point mm-hmm. in their lives. Mm-hmm. And it's a fun read.
It's funny. That reminded me of Atlanta's Center for Puppetry Arts had a theatrical production originally written by a guy named John Ludwig called Avanti da Vinci.
Yes. And I remember it.
It presented Leonardo da Vinci as a Batman-like hero, and it took kind of the original drawings of da Vinci and had them as if they had actually worked and stuff like that. So I guess my other recommendation is to have a time machine, go back 10 or 15 years and see Avanti da Vinci at the Center for Puppetry Arts.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are echoes of that. That's one of the first things I thought of when I read the first issue of Jonathan Hickman's S.H.I.E.L.D. Mm-hmm. book, where one of the first things you see is Da Vinci, I think, fighting Galactus.
Yeah.
it's funny because Roosevelt in this book is kind of, you know, the Nick Fury of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, mm-hmm. bringing everybody together. And you've got Thomas Edison, who is not very, you know, not a likable character here, mm-hmm. who's basically like Forge. Like, he has a secret chamber yeah. full of like futuristic weapons and mm-hmm. stuff. Like, it's goofy, but it's also kind of, yeah. it's also a lot of fun.
Tesla made some of these actually, but
there is a reference to Tesla. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As a matter of fact, but anyway,
yeah.
So those are our recommendations.
Okay, cool. So I guess it's time to start making our way out, you know, and next week we're going to take inspiration from Spider-Man Homecoming, which is opening July 7th. So we're going to use that as inspiration to talk about Amazing Fantasy 15, the origin of Spider-Man story. And supposedly, I think they've been pretty clear that Spider-Man Homecoming's not going to be an origin story, but we're doing the origin anyway for our purposes. And we'll probably talk about another Spider-Man story to like pad out the episode.
But, To be named later.
We had a plan, and the plan might be not working, so we might come up with something else. But definitely Amazing Fantasy number 15. Meanwhile, the Comics Canon can be found on the hoary hosts of podcasting, iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher, as well as our website, comicscanon.com. The Comics Canon is presented with the support of Creative Loafing Atlanta, creator of such podcasts as Mo Audio and Dish on the Dish.
And, dear listeners, we want to hear from you. Rate and review the show on iTunes. You can also email us at letters@comicscanon.com. Post or comment on our Facebook page, or hit us up on Twitter @TheComicsCanon, and we'll read your correspondence in a future episode. Also, if you go to comicscanon.com, you'll find show notes for this episode with links that help expound on some of the topics that we've talked about, including one or more of the Alan Moore interviews that we've mentioned and things of that nature. This podcast was produced by Grayson Bergman. For the Comics Canon, I'm Kevin Morrow.
And I'm Kurt Holman. The Comics Canon will be continued next time with Amazing Fantasy 15, The Origin of Spider-Man.